psychology, obviously the change is not here, and Mithilis is not coming. Brendan is an alternate member, isn't it? Yeah, those are the apologies we received for this, and Mr. Nkwankwa from the UDM. So just a reminder, we will be starting on page 61, chapter 9. We'll adopt the same system that the chair has been, or we will go close by close. If there's any further comments, we'll entertain them. So if you are ready, let's start with part one on the application and interpretation. 129.1, members. Any comments? No? Okay, let's go then to 130.1A. It's a whole insertion of a new sentence. Any comments? Oh, you want?
Explain the comments that we received and what we have in discussion. And I'm going to ask if there are people coming here, because this is quite a critical point of view.
Okay.
The issue relates to whether or not you can be discriminating against the investigators after conducting investigations. And I think we all know from the movies where you have a right to make violence and to say that you can be against you. And as a result, that is the situation that I think. My understanding is you can't give information that may lead to being discriminated in a criminal proceeding.
So sure you can.
You can. So this situation is slightly different for civil actions. So perhaps there are things that sort of can give us a little flavor of what we try to do in response. We have just amended a little bit just to make sure that we don't keep it
going. Okay, over to you, Cyrus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this legal professional privilege is nothing new. It's always been in our legislation, and it's basically just to protect any communication between a lawyer and his client. So some parts of this bill, as does the current legislation, gives us quite intrusive powers. So this is to balance those intrusive powers to make sure that we can't use that type of communication against an individual.
May I have a follow-up? If you're saying intrusive powers, are we juxtaposing it to the FIC bill that you considered certain parts that were deemed to be unconstitutional by the Constitutional Court?
No, ma'am, this is, if you look at this chapter, you'll see there's basically three parts of the chapter. The first one is just gathering information, which is the least intrusive part, and it only relates to regulated entities, in other words, entities that the FSB already has, or the new entity has already has a relationship with in terms of a license. And then the second part goes into the type of on-site review and on-site visit that's a little bit more intrusive. And the last part, from clause 134 onwards, is very intrusive, and that's the investigations, the actual forensic investigation. So in the last part, you are dealing with an investigation that's focused on the idea that there is likely to be something wrong. The previous parts are not like that. And in that sense, you do need to protect against legal professional privilege, and later on you will also see against incriminating yourself.
Okay. Roy? You may.
Thank you. I just wanted to basically say what Wes just said, that this whole chapter we have drafted and commented on taking into account the constitutional judgments, most recent constitutional judgments on these issues.
Okay, thank you. Any further comments on that? I see. Is the stakeholders also being engaged on this one? I see a hand from WhatsApp. Yes. Do you mind coming to the microphone?
from a CISA, Madam Chair, just to explain to the committee that a CISA's counsel is satisfied that all of the constitutional issues that a CISA raised have been addressed in the published draft of the bill that was published in July. Thank you.
Thank you, Inbasa.
Okay.
Okay, members, I think we can proceed then to part two, having seen that everybody is satisfied with this clause. Information gathering, 131. Any comments? Roy? This is a newly proposed chapter. You have engaged on it probably. Members, here is a new proposition that is being inserted, 129. I don't know, I can't see there. My eyes are not so good. So I need to look back down. The microphone can't follow me to the back. The Council for Medical Schemes. Unless you just make it bigger, then I can. Yeah, but the microphone can't follow me to the back. Yeah. Can we quickly look into that, David? And see whether it is the way it's suggested. Which powers are these? Can we make a reflection, perhaps, Casey, and so that members can understand which powers are we referring to?
Okay, so just to remind the committee that there are a number of different regulators involved in the financial space. So we've spoken a lot about the credit regulator, but also involved is the Council for Medical Schemes. And in effect, you have these companies they're insurers of health products, a medical team, that's what it's doing. So they are, just like the risks we've identified, the prudential risk, the stability risk, and the conduct risk, if you think about the likelihood of the discovery, which is a sizable institution, it's important that those financial institutions are also brought within the ambit of the Twin Peaks framework. So that clause, that reference where you see it, section 282, talks about the powers of this bill relating to prudence and conduct that can be exercised by the Council for Medical Schemes. So here, it's just a cleanup to connect between the powers described in this section, in this chapter, to that clause at the end, which says that the council can be exercising those powers on behalf of the prudential authority and the conduct authority, and it's, as Roy pointed out, it's for clarity and to make that technique more clear.
The last question for me is the delegated power from the prudential authority to
council. That is correct. Well. The way that it's described in terms of the power, in terms of the section 282, is that the minister would upfront determine we're going to give you these powers, but those powers must be exercised with the concurrence of the respective authorities.
Okay, members. I think this is just to make it in line with other sections. Do you have any comments, perhaps? David?
Just simply to say that this is would have to be parked under one of the substantive issues, which is dual regulation.
Okay, members. I hope you're okay with it. This one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just to add, so the FSRB repeals the current Inspections of Financial Institutions Bill or Act, and in that Act, the Medical Council is afforded, or they utilise the same piece of legislation to do investigations. So this is also just to be a backstop to ensure that they wouldn't lose any current power that they have under the Inspections Act.
I think it's clear. If there's no further comments, then let's move. Don't forget it when we get the clean bill that we have this new insertion, because it doesn't appear on the July 1 as it stands. So it will be inserted there. Okay. When we go to 2, it's written 2-1 that is pressed, Alan. I was still trying to get clarity here. Okay. It's 131. So when this comes up, B. Yes. Yeah. Then it will have to be corrected because as then. Maybe on your system.
We'll make sure that the numbers, I think it may possibly be sometimes with the track changing, it can be a little bit confusing how the numbering goes, but we'll make sure that that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Can you show it, maybe the clean version there? Okay, we're on A. It's 2A. Yeah, we're on 2A. Members, Brenda. You guys are quiet today. We're on 2A. Any comments on 2A? Okay, so I take it you are satisfied with... So can we go to Roman figure 1 then? So you call it A financial law.
Madam Chair, it's a financial sector law and it's defined to include all the legislation that we would administer.
Okay. Okay. Let's go to Roman figure 2. So we've changed financial sector to responsible authority on domain figure 2. Any comments, member? No? Okay, then let's move to domain figure 3. I think it's just technical changes. Except that you have expunged a supervised entity that has been given a notice in terms of subsection 1. It's been expunged. That's B. Can we then move to 3? There's no changes there. We find with part 2, members. Can we then move to part 3? Supervisory on-site inspections. It's now going to start as 132, isn't it? Not 131 as it was before. And the changes there are, a financial sector regulator may at any reasonable time, you know, I always raise these things, how can you measure reasonability? So I can't do it today, the chair is not here, so I don't know how to start that. Let's take we agree that reasonable is reasonable. And Basa Mazin say it was not reasonable enough for us. It was too short. Oh, you know, it's reasonable. And Advocate Jenkins, you find it in a way reasonable time as is. Yes, okay. Okay, members, let's move to the next one. So are we in, it's now this, after giving reasonable notice to the supervised entity, I think new changes made there. I think it amplified the reasonable time, isn't it?
But I'd say the first reasonable time refers to when you're allowed to when you're allowed to enter the business premises. So it's just better wording than saying during normal business hours, because I suppose business hours also differ a lot. The second one is about how much time do you have to reply.
It's issues that will always be challenged in court of law. Even there's businesses that doesn't operate during office hours, that operates at night in private properties. I don't want to go back to that debate. I engaged in it when we were dealing with the FSV matters. I still believe that we are stripping too much power from the FSV. So it's my personal private issue. Okay, members, can we then look at A, 2A? Keith, maybe you want to explain more on this one. Let's come in.
Yes,
you may.
This is, as I say, we're moving into the on-site inspections now. In other words, a little bit more intrusive. What has happened is the bill now actually stipulates why you would be able to do something like an on-site visit. And once again, it is drafted in this manner to keep constitutionality in mind, to make sure that we're inside the parameters of our constitution. So it gives the different possibilities there to check compliance and to check compliance with an enforceable undertaking, which is something new in this world that we haven't had before, and then of course to determine risk. And if you look at sub 3, once again, the wording there reflects what the constitution expects of us.
I hope you consult the officers that visit us on this one. So we don't want them tomorrow to come and engage us at a different level and say, you know, this is what we don't want and all that. I hope it's fine. I think it's okay, remember? Okay, thank you. Can we then move to 4A?
Madam Chair, Section 4, or Clause 4A sets out what you might do on an on-site inspection. So it's once again less intrusive than an investigation, but it gives the on-site inspector the right to examine documents, question persons, make extracts, and in some circumstances remove the documents.
Comments, members? No? Okay. It covers all Roman figure 1 until Roman figure 4. I mean, Roman figure 5 then has sub AA, give the written directive to the supervised entity or the person apparently in charge of the premises to ensure that no person removes from the premises or conceals, destroys, or otherwise interferes with any business document. Another member? I think it's silence means concern.
Yeah.
Thank you. Then we move to sub BB. I think it's just technical. Why does it start with BB then go to B?
No, it's
sub of No. Yeah, okay. A directive in terms of paragraph A, Roman Sida 3, or 5, sub AA, is effective if given to a person apparently in charge of the premises. The word apparently in this context, what does it mean? Apparently.
Madam Chair, that gives the on-site inspector the room to consider the situation and decide who is in charge and make a judgment call on the premises, because sometimes we've learned the hard way that if you arrive at a premises where there is something going on that shouldn't be going on, then suddenly nobody is in charge. And often it's very difficult to find somebody in charge.
Okay, so you're really tightening on that one, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm apparently acting, so I'm not in charge. William Mavi is here, because he ran away from taking his due responsibilities. Okay, honourable members, I think we're fine with that. Let's move to... No, C. We replace any with the... and remove document with documents. I think it's a slight correction.
Yes, Madam Chair, it's just an improvement on the writing. The idea behind this clause has always existed, and that is if you remove any documentation, you must give the person a receipt for it, because that's another thing that we've learned the hard way, is that if a case goes the wrong way for the inspected party, they usually end up accusing us of throwing away their documents so they can't put up a defense.
Okay, I think this section belongs to you, all of it. Let's then move to...
Okay,
can we go to D? It's the inclusion of the word business document.
Yes, Madam Chair, that is to distinguish it from other documents. We are obviously only interested in business documents and not the personal lives of some of these people. So this is just about the fact that we can keep it for as long as it's necessary. And of course, if you then look at the next subparagraph E, the inspected party, the investigated party may have access to it and may make copies or extracts from the document, so that we don't completely bring the business to a standstill unless we mean to do so. In many instances, Madam Chair, this will not really work out this way, because we've also moved a little bit with the times, so we mirror image electronic storing devices and we scan physical copies, but sometimes it's not possible.
Any comments, members? No? Okay, let's move to supervisory on-site inspection. It used to be 132, now it's 133. I think that's the new numbering, and it actually expands sub 2, 3, and 4. I think it's just to deal with the numerics as it stands, then I think we can move to part 4.
So if we look at part 4, as lawyer said, this is not because we do risk-based supervision or because we have some audit or review program for the year. This is where there's actually a suspicion that there's contravention. So it's a bit of a different story. But we do have a lot of safeguards built in, not just because of the Constitution, also because we want to do it right. And 134.1 is the first one, and that is the financial sector regulator must appoint an investigator. So not everybody can do that. Obviously, there's a process that you go through in terms of fit and proper and technical abilities and so forth. And then in subsection 2, it deals with the certificate and the fact that you must produce it if requested.
Yeah, I just want to deliberately check with David on this one. David, in the last legislation, he had an issue with appointment of a private investigator. He made a lot of... So he forgot, fortunately, he did not read this one. So good. It is not going to have an issue that we can have, but don't bring us back. You see, it's good that I see it. Sometimes you lose your good memory. So you can't juxtapose your argument in the other legislation to this one on the same method. You don't have an amendment as you speak. So you're happy with this one? I take it. Oh, David.
Madam Chair, maybe if I can help.
Can you just explain it further? Because I think it will be okay to go back to it when we have an ample opportunity to engage on it. So can you give it more meat so that even any issue that David will want to raise, we can be able to address it today?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The appointment, obviously in practice, mostly these are permanent appointments and long-term training, etc. But there are instances where it is necessary to appoint an outside expert. We do it from time to time if it involves an investigation that's of a highly technical nature. Collective investment schemes, for instance, we have one now where there's no way that an internal team will really understand all the intricacies. And then you can do it merely for managing resources. It's certainly something that doesn't happen often. But if it happens, there's a very specific process to make sure that that person is have no conflict of interest. But we do that with the internal investigators as well. Always you check for conflict of interest and for technical capability. Over and above that, it is standard procedure to appoint an internal investigator with an external investigator for many reasons. One is, of course, that the internal investigator knows the procedures, etc., and the law about forensics, and also for skills transfer.
Thank you. I don't think we have any discussion for that. Remember, sometimes not to show me an indication that you're okay. Okay. No. No, we've been doing well so far.
Yeah.
David, we've been doing well so far. Everybody has been behaving. Let's keep it that way. I'll remind you of the song I said to myself every day, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. So if you can sing it before we start the meeting, I think we'll stay very peaceful for the better part of the day. Okay. Let's move to powers to conduct investigation. I think it's the same, except that there's this changes of the words, pursuant to and by a designated authority in terms of a bilateral or multilateral agreement or memorandum of understanding contemplated in section 2.4.2.
Okay.
I think what...
Sorry, Madam Chair. Yes, the first one, A, sub A, is, as I said before, this is now an investigation, so we need some triggering device before you use these powers, and that is that the financial regulator,
the
commissioner...
You need to get rid of the word, the triggering device. Remember, we're giving something in the chamber and we're not happy. So...
So that means there must be a suspicion that there was a contravention before you can use these powers that are much more intrusive than anyone we've seen so far. Subsection B is simply to honor our international agreements to do investigations on behalf of foreign regulators.
Members can we move to two? The financial sector regulator may investigate any matter relating to an offence or contravention referred to in section 78, 80 and 81 of the Financial Markets Act, Act number 19, blah blah blah. I think it covers what Kana has just mentioned. Any comment?
No?
I take it you are all happy. Roy? Yeah, to make it consistent. To, yeah, okay. You understand, members? Is that to make it consistent?
Regent? Oh, yeah. Sector regulator to responsible authority.
Mm. And see, the fact that subsection 2 is in there is because we now will have one investigation unit to do market abuse and
mm-hmm.
all the other investigations, and to make sure that we can investigate all the historical offences. As far as the history of the market abuse legislation is concerned.
Okay, let's move to page 64. Powers of investigators to question and require production of documents or other items. It's changed from 135 to 136.
It's going to see there's not much different from this wording and the current wording that we've operated under. It is basically just the powers to do a proper investigation, which will include the right to summon somebody to be interviewed. I think the old legislation said interrogated. That sounded a bit rough. And then to summon somebody to produce documents. That's Roman 2. Which is standard procedure for any investigation.
Going to B, I don't see any changes in B. Then you go to C, subject to paragraph D. Then you change a capital letter to a small letter. I don't think it's an issue for discussion really. But under Roman figure 1, it does not change blue on the board, does it? But only a document is highlighted in blue.
Madam Chair, the real issue here, the real change here perhaps is that Roman 1 just says that we can keep the documentation for our enforcement and other action. If you then go down to Roman 2,
it says it's no longer necessary.
If it's no longer necessary, and if you go down to D2,
if it says it is no longer necessary. So can we check whether it's as it stands? Or is it the U.S. saying if on my document says it's no longer necessary? You see what I'm saying? Can we verify that, Gerrit?
Yes, that's correct, Madam Chair. You keep the documentation for as long as it's necessary, and you have to give it back if it's no longer necessary. But, of course, with a very important qualification in Roman 2, there are some rare instances where you do not want to give the documentation back. And this is especially true in situations where it is bank details of clients who are being abused or misused to recover money, etc. So we've had that type of situation where you certainly don't want to give that information back to the person you're busy taking action against.
Yeah, but the following subsection, for instance, the document or item has been handed over to a designated authority or in the opinion of the commissioner, it is not in the best interest of the public or any other member or members of the public for the documents or items to be returned. You know, it can be challenged then. Have you discussed and agreed with the sector?
Yes, but we've as we've written this bill, we've discussed it many times. We've made sure that it's not an issue. The first one, the document has been handed over to a designated authority. It's merely just to accommodate the fact that we have to honour our obligations in terms of our agreements with foreign regulators. So if we take the documents, we give it to a foreign regulator, of course we can't give it back then. And then the last one is, as I say, those rare instances where you do not want to give it back. And yes, of course, Madam Chair, you're correct, it can be challenged, but the world we live in, unfortunately, we have to ask ourselves, can it be successfully challenged? And we don't think so.
That's an interesting one. Well, I can be. But it's not for us to determine. Mm-hmm. Because, you know why I'm saying that it's not for us to determine. It's an institution once said there's a prima facie evidence, but it's not winnable. So you don't do that. You don't investigate and make the judgment. You do your work and then you send it there. Then you decide whether it's winnable or not. So we shouldn't. But it's not for us. I'm okay. Thank you. It's not for us to get into that. Right?
Okay, we just want to make a change from commissioner to responsible authority.
If I were to make a general comment, that I don't know whether we do have a proviso which says with all these investigations and so on, because by the way, let's not forget the institution is assumed innocent, right? That it shouldn't interfere with the running of the business, because sometimes people are very eager to investigate and so on, and you find that those documents may be necessary for running the business. I'm just saying, I don't know how do we mitigate against that risk.
See, this is a follow-up question on what I said, that it can be challengeable, the way that I don't know how will we quality different, unless if, because the words in the opinion, it says opinion, it doesn't talk about legal basis. And that's why I thought maybe Advocate Dentist will have something to say, because it says opinion.
Madam
opinion
Chair.
Is an opinion. It's not a legal thing. I don't want to argue like a lawyer. I'm not. But I just want it to be tied so that it's not challenged in the way it is. And he raises a fundamental question that if it's going to obscure business, but the other clauses did make mention that it will not. The document will not be kept if it's going to hamper the process. That's why copies will be made. Brandon, let me give you an opportunity.
Madam Chair, I think the Commissioner will still have to justify his opinion if challenged. But bearing in mind at this point, these investigations are not really against legitimate businesses. So, you know, if you're obscuring the business of a pyramid scheme, it's not a bad thing necessarily. So the Commissioner will effectively have to justify if challenged. So if you went into Standard Bank and say, I'm keeping these documents, you know, you'll have to have a very strong case, because they'll run off to court and say that's unlawful. Remember, this, most of this stuff is we're dealing with probably serious criminal minds that are using the law cleverly to actually do more harm than petty crime, you know, murders and people like that. These guys, so it's either more onerous provision, and you'll have to justify his opinion.
But remember, some of the Ponzi schemes are not Ponzi schemes in front, they're Ponzi schemes at the back. In front is something very clean, at the back is something else. So, well, I don't want to say my opinions. I still believe you have still too much power away from our guys to do the work. So I don't want to get involved in, so I've lost that argument. Because the Constitution, it's so cumbersome sometimes. I don't want to say anything. I want us to make that we don't spend money on litigation processes unnecessarily, that the way we call the legislation protect even the investigators themselves to be. So I only had the word opinion. Maybe we should hear how you justify opinion as a legal argument.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One needs to read that opinion with the next part, and I agree with Mr. Tobin, and that is it must also not be in the best interest of the public. So that's the real test, and that is something that certainly has a lot of case law around it. And if you are abusing your powers in this instance, you certainly will lose this case, and you certainly will get a cost over against you. So there is a balance of power in that instance. But the cases where we would not want to give documents back will be so clear-cut. As Mr. Zomers has indicated, it's either a case of a Ponzi scheme or completely unlawful running of debit orders of accounts, etc., where there's no basis to do so, where the information has been stolen and so forth. So that's the environment that this type of clause will be invoked now.
I don't think we should belabor the point. Okay, thank you.
Because you promised me, but
I wanted to be tied.
The legality on that, as it's developed now, is that it must be exercised. Any discretion must be exercised in a rational manner, which means both procedurally and substantively it must be rational. So the way that the commissioner or the responsible authority arrives at his or her opinion must be rationally connected to why that document shouldn't be. And then, of course, the why is also then investigated. So it is well challengeable if there's an abuse of power.
The test lies with you guys to prove the point in your work. I don't wish that it happens where you are put to test and then the legal battle takes place where you need to prove beyond reasonable doubt that you have a winnable case. I can cite many instances where I've seen our system being taken to task. Honorable Tillis.
Chair, I wouldn't belabor the point, but it's very clear that there's a lot of subjectivity in the opinion, in somebody's opinion. I guess it's in the nature of law. That's why I prefer 1 + 1 = 2. It can't be an opinion, right? But I'm sure in law that's what it is. But we shouldn't be fooling ourselves. I think in the recent months we have seen a lot of power abuse, and somebody's just saying it's in the opinion and without coming up with a very scientific basis of the action that one is taking. So I'm just saying that we should be have very clear checks and balances that this thing is not abused going forward. Thank you.
Oh, you think like me, on this one, because I've always made examples that a certain O.J. Simpson killed his wife. There was overwhelming evidence, but because of small mistakes, people lost on a very big case. I followed it religiously, and I followed many other cases religiously, where subjective elements dealt with the legal matters in such a way that, and it's a human error, it's inherent in human beings to do. So not even the law can protect you from that human element. It will always be there. But I don't think, when I said we shouldn't believe it, I was trying to say, let's not discuss it to a point, because the legal advice is that it will have to be put to a test. So we take it for that, that opinion will be based on legal basis that will have been established based on the work that the investigators will have done. So to me it suffices. But I would have not personally have preferred the word opinion being put in law. I would have preferred something stronger to make it more tighter. Because if you say an opinion, a person can say it's your opinion. And an opinion remains an opinion. Doesn't become the fact. So to me, I would have preferred a different way. But I don't want us to waste time on it. Because the lawyers are here. They know the best way to utilize in this regard. And
Chair, you again, you shouldn't take the work of the lawyers away. That's how they make money.
I always say we just keep this, you know. You and trust many things, my comrade. I don't trust myself. I don't want to say that to our advocate, but I respect these people. I depend on them. I do trust law. I'm a bush lawyer. Right? I don't know, but just consider it. I'll be okay with any. You know, my comrades are having a conversation, and they are the ones who are raising these issues with me. Dikeledi, I don't know what they try to do to bother with Dikeledi.
He's out of on.
He's happy. Oh. You know. I'm always the one who's at fault all the time, so today I'm trying to be the saint, you see. So we'll pack the word. It will come back maybe if there's a need for any change, but we'll have discussed the issues. And because if it's left for interpretation, that's where it becomes a problem. Imagine taking to court for the word of opinion only, and not even the facts that you've gathered, or the information that you have gathered, but you are taking either for one word, it was your opinion, therefore it's not correct, and then it, the case goes to and from, you know, the expenses incurred on that. Okay, members, let's move. You need to help me.
So for the rest of that session, Madam Chair, the D that's now E, just deals with the investigated party may have access to these documents. As I say, this rarely ever happens because we actually take copies. We don't take the originals anymore. And then the last subsection 2, has just been changed to improve the wording, to say that a person has been questioned, taking down his statement, so to speak, is entitled to have legal representation to protect his rights.
We'll pass the constitutional master, definitely. Yeah, okay. Okay, well. It's only copies, and like Khalid explained, today you just scan them and, you know, you have a better system of getting information without having to hamper the operations of any business. Okay, let's move to powers of investigator to enter a search plan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the first part of that section, subsection 1A, it gives you the three ways that you can enter premises, search premises. The first one is the easy one that I've never seen in my life, and that's with the consent of the person apparently in charge. But I have another 10 years to go, so let's hope. And this, No, Madam Chair, we will not tell you that we're coming. And the second one, the AA, if the entry is authorized by a warrant. And that's the one that is obviously utilized in most instances where we have a suspicion that there's contraventions being this authorization of a warrant, the rest of the section sets out how this happens, and this is something that has been redrafted a bit to get it in line with recent judgments on the issue of warrantless searches. You might have seen the Auction Alliance matter and the Birdner matter, and so forth. So we've studied those cases and we've got opinions on it, and we've aligned our legislation with them. So we've taken the cautious approach and we said you need a warrant basically in all instances.
Members, members? They're still looking at it. What else has been obtained in the past with false identity? We're going to house A, then cell phones have been observed under a pretext that it's Mrs. Tavares for a long to find that it's Miss Kikana's phone that's going to be observed. Yes, it has happened. I'm referring to cases. So I hope in this case we're not going to be taken to task for such events.
Madam Chair, we're lucky that we don't really do surveillance. And very lucky that we don't do stakeouts at all. So we really just start after the warrant, and to get a warrant from a judge or a magistrate, you have to prove certain facts in existence. And if you want to lie about that, you're forced to lie on the case, which will certainly be problematic if you're caught out. Of course, the BB must be taken into account, and that's those rare instances where you don't have time to get a warrant. Once again, I've never seen that. We hear about something, we get instructed by the registrar, and we obtain the warrant fairly quickly.
But I think this is very clear, and to me it's okay. Can we then move? Warrant 3 is also a numerical change. I don't know whether there's any substance changes, right? And then we take 5, the same, it's a numeric change. And then we go to page 65, it's a numerical change on 6. But Roman figure 1 has or be relevant to the request.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, that is just to narrow the powers a bit. In other words, whatever you do, whatever you look for, must be relevant to the request. In this instance, the request that's referred to, if I may take you back, ma'am, to the fact that we do investigations on behalf of foreign counterparts. So if it's that type of investigation where it's merely at request in terms of an MMOU or an MOU, our powers are to collect that information, that documentation that's relevant to the request. It doesn't open the door for us to do a full investigation on an entity that we otherwise would not have had jurisdiction over.
I take it you're okay, then. The others, there's no changes up until to Roman figure 7, is the same as on or be relevant to a request.
That's correct, ma'am. That's the same situation.
Then I go to B, correct?
Thank you, ma'am. So this is back to what you've seen before, that you the investigator must provide a receipt, a written receipt to the person from whom you take the information. And the changes there, as far as I can see, it's just better wording.
Members, no comments? Okay, mm-hmm. Can we proceed to C?
Thank you. So this is basically a repeat of what we saw before, is what do you do with all the documents that you've collected? And there's provision for the fact that as a standard, as a baseline, you must give it back, except if you can show that it will not be in the best interest of the public. And the suggestion of Roy earlier, to say maybe we should reword and lose the opinion bit, that will be equally applicable here, and we have no objection to that, ma'am.
Okay, let's go to E then. I think it's a numerical change, and then there's 7, sub-7. An investigator and any person assisting an investigator, as mentioned in subsection 5, may use reasonable force to exercise any power in terms of this section. Don't worry, these guys are not carrying those other things. I think members are having beef on this one. Reasonable force.
Yes, Madam.
How reasonable if you gag me, is that reasonable force?
No, ma'am, this is merely to get into premises, and it's nothing to do with kicking down doors. We don't do the stuff that you see on television. The most exciting thing we do is we call a locksmith to come and open the door for us. But that is just to give us the right to call a locksmith to open the door of the safe.
Why did you have to use the word reasonable force? Why didn't you say to gain entrance or any other thing? Why did you have to say force? I mean, force is force. No, it's not gaining entrance. It's force. It will always be perceived as force. If my grandmother's antique door has been unscrewed from the wall or something like that, I don't know. You shouldn't be using cumbersome words. They are very difficult to explain.
Madam Chair, I think you make a good point, and we would not have objection to changing that, maybe to take reasonable measures.
I'm just saying, I don't know, maybe I'm just being too kind.
No, you're right.
Maybe because we have this in the back of our mind. You know, I remember when my grandmother's door was kicked and her blankets were moved, and she was not wearing a very long pyjama, and I was very offended. There's a type of forces that you remember. So when, once it's forced, you have this thing in the back of your mind. And you say, hey, you know, so somebody can argue, how do you measure the reasonability of force? And you mean well, but it can be interpreted differently. And I don't know. I leave it to you, members.
So I think he has come up with a better way, reasonable measure too. Yeah. You see, force, we definitely associate it with force.
Okay,
Brandon. I'm most happy with the word measured, but I was coming to the word force. Remember, there's a police officer company, and the police officers have, you know, well developed rules which have developed a long time since the front had rule. So, but measured is a better word, but as long as it's understood, that could include force from time to time. A measure could include force, but I think the word measure is acceptable. It does. But it's.
I don't want us to make them just change the words. We need to have a legal cover in the sense.
Ma'am, she also bear in mind, the investigators are nerds. They're like me. They're accountants. You know, sometimes they're lawyers. But generally, they're bookkeepers going in to check the entries. They're not like super cops. So I think...
I don't want them to go alone. Because sometimes they will meet personalities. We've got different personalities. It's not given that an accountant is going to meet another accountant. It's the person who's been suspected of wrongdoing. They're not going to be nice to you. They're not welcoming because they know that you are taking them somewhere they don't like. You know? So sometimes they need to be accompanied. They are safe. I asked this before when we were dealing with the other legislation, how safe you are when you go there. And we shouldn't assume that all the premises are nice office blocks. Some businesses do not operate from nice office blocks. They operate from very interesting, dingy places that you'll be shocked that there's such activities taking place there. And there's no law that prohibits a person to operate from anywhere, so far as we're dealing with. But let me give you, comrade.
Chair, please pull me out of order. But I thought I was going to raise this point towards the end, but since we are talking about investigators, I think the bill is very silent as to who can be appointed as an investigator. Well, it may be both in terms of skills, but again in terms of probity. What type of a probity that somebody should meet if they're going to be appointed as an investigator? I know, for instance, in other industries, I said I was a regulator in gambling, the probity of an investigator and an inspector is very important, because it starts giving you the type of a person that will be going there. Is a person that is fit and proper to do that way? So I'm not sure whether you do cover it somewhere, but I didn't see it as who can be appointed as an investigator is very critical.
Yeah, before I give to Advocate Jenkins and Gerard, I just want to make this anecdote. When in my previous life, we had campaigns to go and search unlicensed liquor distributors and places. So some of my investigators were young women and men, very thin, and they go to a place where they're going to take away cases of liquor. So we had to request the police to accompany them. And sometimes I was there myself, so you can imagine. So I was lucky because I had some guys who always go with me. But it's a very interesting question that you're asking, that we might want to make sure the safety of people when they... Advocate Jenkins, if you're certain, or welcome on Love Listener.
Thank you, ma'am. I'm not talking about the reasonable force, because again the reasonableness depends on circumstances, so one case will differ from another, but certainly one can't use a digger loader or a front loader to push down the wall if there's a door that you can knock in. I can use such an extreme example. Very difficult to actually pinpoint and to use words to cover each possible scenario. Myself, I haven't studied, I can look at it a little bit if the committee would require that, but it reminds one a bit of the whole controversy around Section 49 of the Criminal Procedure Act and what is reasonable and what is not. So even in that circumstance, the Constitutional Court said, well, it's fair to put it like that in legislation. So I'm not overly concerned about it.
But you can keep it. If the Constitutional Court would say it's okay, we don't have to change it. Remember, I was just raising it.
Yes, I think also in the context that it's written, it's not saying you must use new reasonable measures to in order to exercise. I think what it's providing for is in those exceptional cases where there might be exceptional resistance, you can use stronger measures. So if it's placed right at the end, the way that it's positioned, and those stronger measures by definition would imply some force, but then it must be reasonable in that context. I think it's actually deliberate to give the investigator some leeway, but again, as decided, we can relook at this if decided.
Yeah, but if the Constitutional Court says it's okay, I don't think we should be consistent and not necessarily change it. That's why I was saying it's because of these things that we still have in the back of our minds. They might not be justifiable in future or in that court particular conjunction. So it shouldn't influence how we... Because sometimes it's just to raise them, not necessarily to say it. So if it has been captured, I think it's... Remember, anyway, it will go to the court of law. That's, the court becomes the final arbiter in terms of how you acted, and it can either vindicate any person in this instance. Okay, members, if there's no further engagement on that, can we then move?
Respectful and protection of dignity.
Can we then move to Warren?
Chair. I don't think I've been responded to. On who can be appointed as an investigator, and I spoke about this, whether it's skill, perhaps the skill is assumed, but I also spoke about the probity.
Okay,
Madam Chair, yes, I think we believe it's a very good point that the Honourable Member is making, and we would suggest perhaps that we add wording to the effect that firstly, an inspector can't be a disqualified person, which is quite widely defined in this Act, which will exclude everybody, including those who are not sound of mind. And then perhaps we can add to that such person must have no conflict of interest over and above the disqualified person.
Okay,
let me first check with Honorable Cecil, is that covered? Yes, I'm sure they can still look at other things. I was just saying that we need to cover it somewhere so that we make sure we don't have rogue people being in spaces.
I hope they won't qualify. No, that's all. It's a very interesting environment. Oh, no. Let's not use the words rogue here. They relate to other issues. They relate to other issues. Let's just look at this one, this legislation as it stands, and just clean our minds from other matters, and then we'll come back to those other matters somewhere else. Honorable Brandon?
And Chair, can we also maybe add in reasonable skills required to do the job or something like that? I think that will take care of it.
It covers your point in the committee, sir. Is it a reasonable skill?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Honorable Lee?
Madam Chair, we're going to park this one until we see the final draft of Lee's change.
Actually, it will come out in the meeting, sir. We'll have. Because there's more than one honorable list that we have made changes to, so it will be highlighted. But also, can we request that the document should not only be black and white? I don't know whether it's only me who had a privilege or the character. I don't see it even there. So can we highlight those changes? So that
it's because you are the chair. We have a black and white.
Oh, no, I didn't get it when I was a chair. It's my old document. No, mine is also black and white, but it's highlighted nicely. And don't say it's Alan who gave me. I've been having it for some time. It's not now. Okay. So we're covered by that, isn't it? We move. B is also a numeric change. Interference with investigation. First, 139 is a numeric change, but we've got sub B.
Just in subclause 1A in 138, we would just want to propose clarifying that the judge or magistrate must have jurisdiction in the area. Just to be absolutely clear, it was requested that we clarify that.
Well, then it suggests that a magistrate might not have jurisdiction. Has it ever happened?
Yes, Madam Chair, it will be a geographical issue. In other words, that you're in the wrong district, you should go to another magistrate, or even with a judge, that you're in the wrong province. It's really just tying it up.
Would there be an insertion there?
Yes, the suggestion is that it's inserted any judge or magistrate who has jurisdiction in the area where the premises in question are located.
Yes, fine, member.
And just a clarification question. Is it legally possible for us to give a judge jurisdiction outside his province? It's not possible in any event, because it would be quite helpful for you. But it's not possible. So this is.
Why do you say it would be helpful? It means
because the FSB is based in Pretoria, so most of the work is done there, for instance. Now, let's say there's something in the Free State. It would be easier to go get the warrants and all the expertise of the FSB or the Reserve Bank are based for, but it's not legally possible. That's all.
Order of court of a high court applies nationally, but of course it has persuasive force in terms of precedent. So that's something else than jurisdiction for a warrant. Certain magistrates are connected to the areas where they work in, but it's not possible for us in this legislation to change it unless we do it explicitly, because if I'm not mistaken, this legislation has one of those standard clauses in from the Treasury that it prevails if there's a conflict with other legislation. So we have to look at that.
So it's a very valid point raised by the honourable member. We mustn't do it subconsciously or unintendedly that we're changing the High Courts Act or something like that. That's not what we should do. So we must certainly look at that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Was there a precedent in this regard that you would want you to set it as the inclusion that you want to make? Was a particular precedent set before that has made it cumbersome for you, for warrants to be obtained?
Madam Chair, just to clear up, we don't want any judge or magistrate to have jurisdiction outside his geographical area. We're saying that we will go to the correct magistrate or the correct judge. I think if we extend that beyond jurisdiction, you might run into forum shopping. If you don't get it from magistrate A, you go to the district next door and maybe get a more favorable ruling. So what we're saying here is we stick to the jurisdiction as set out in the courts.
And is it set out in the Courts Act?
As far as jurisdiction in South Africa is concerned, certain courts have jurisdiction over certain areas, and we are quite happy to stay within it. It is correct, as Mr. Topman said, that it gives you a bit more work because you have to travel the day before and then quietly go to the magistrate in chambers and ask for a warrant and then go and do the work. But that's okay. That's in line with how we should be behaving.
Okay, Jenkins?
I'm just looking at the wording now, and I'm not sure if we're doing word counts or anything like that, but one can just say judge or magistrate with jurisdiction. All we want to do is make the point that whoever has jurisdiction, that's unaffected by the legislation, and the inspector must go and seek a warrant from that authority with jurisdiction. I'm not sure if I'm helping or taking it back, but I'll leave it at that.
Madam Chair, we have a slight problem in that these things are sometimes opposed and fought afterwards and so forth, and it impacts on admissibility. So you could do a lot of work and it comes to nothing. So they could raise issues about which magistrate did have jurisdiction and on what basis did he have jurisdiction. If we clear it up and we say in the area where the premises are located, then it really narrows any chance of taking a point at a later stage.
Actually, before I give to you, let me just sort of explain how I understand it. I think the way you're couching it, it's helpful even to cover honorable's case of concern that a particular magistrate will have been preferred over a one who presides over a jurisdiction. Because if it's covered in a jurisdiction, it cannot be questionable that why did you prefer to get the warrant in a particular jurisdiction that's not within the location of the person or the institution that you're dealing with. If you can agree on that one, then it makes it easier because it will not say there was an element of shopping or hunting. It was pure basic work. I don't know. I understand it to cover that point. Brendan?
Just wondering whether it doesn't restrict you. It says that people have got five premises in different provinces. The way it's worded there, you'll have to get five different court orders. Whereas I think if you will probably only get one court order for the head office, which would cover the branches, etc. So, and there could be a lot of premises in some cases, specifically the provinces. So maybe I think Advocate Jenkins' proposal will cover you even yet, and it's wider. So if they say the jurisdiction, the changes in the future, you might want to go with the Courts Act changes or whichever act it is. So maybe I think
one has to park it for a later discussion. You consider all the views, and we come back later on it.
Yeah, we will bring back to it if you want to make sure that you support that.
Very quiet today. Okay, we reset it back for a wedding consideration, and maybe it will come back. Don't forget it. Let's get it highlighted as part of your clicking. Okay, let's move to where are we now? I tend to lose my. Are we on sub 2? Sub 2, yes. Interference with investigation,
Sarah. Thank you, Manager. Just sorry to take you back to 138.1B. I don't think you can see that, but there's a deletion of 138.1B. The application must include a statement on oath and so forth. And it's just. That's right. And so it's the wording is just improved there to bring it closer to what the law actually expects of us when we apply for a warrant. And we request that deletion takes place of B.
You see it in your documents, members? It should be reflecting on your document. You see it on your document? Yeah. Okay. We can move to 139.
Eight. Madam Chair, 139. I don't know if you can see it, but we request that a 2, 3, 4, and 4 be inserted. Sub 2, 3, and 4 inserted. And it replaces the 3, 4, and 5 that used to be there, or that's there at the moment, and it's to get the cross references right to other parts of the bowl and so forth.
Can I see the issue in members on your document? On double disk?
Just clarity, so the document I have in front of me is the one that has been changed, not the one that still has to be changed. I can't look at a screen and a document. I look at the document in front of me. What am I looking at?
Change document.
Check with him. Do you have the July version? Because in the July version, you'll see the changes, and at the back, the deleted versions still appear in red. Well, maybe in your document doesn't reflect the colors, but you'll have 2, 3, 4. Yeah, that's the one. You've got the right one. Yes. And then at the back, the deleted one will appear in red. Can you page over? You will see them in red. Can you see them? Up there, yes. You've got the right document. Changes. Yes. So is there any suggestions on our news? Have you gone through? What do we mean by lawful excuse? Can an excuse be lawful?
Madam Chair, the expression lawful excuse doesn't really mean excuse. It really refers to if you have a lawful or legal reason to refuse to do it and you are within your rights to do so, so to speak. So as an example, the right against self-incrimination, although we deal with it specifically in the next clause, but that will be a good example of a lawful excuse. So you must answer, that is, you have no choice, but there are circumstances where you do have a choice. For instance, marital privilege. You don't have to testify against your wife or your husband. That would be a lawful excuse. So it's not just any excuse.
It should be a lawful.
It's well defined in case law and in the law in general. I don't think it's defined in here. I'll just check quickly. No, it's not a finding.
happy, then we're going to move to part 5, incriminating statements, then this provision, correct? I see you're replacing 139, it's now 140.
Yes.
And,
that's correct, Madam Chair. So there's quite a few changes there if one look at the whole 140. I think some of it was as a result of comments. But if I can maybe speak overall about section 140, it's designed in such a way that when these agencies do an investigation, and that investigation might eventually lead to criminal prosecution, you have a right not to incriminate yourself. So there's a few things that I think is worth lifting out, and the first one is that it only refers to part 4. In other words, it only refers to investigations. And then the protection only extends to criminal proceedings. Our law does not acknowledge this type of rights or protection for administrative proceedings or civil proceedings, so it's criminal. So we made sure we stuck within what is expected of us in terms of the law. The way this has been drafted now, if all these changes are accepted, it will mean that the investigator will have a choice. If somebody raises this defense and say, I don't want to answer on the basis that it will incriminate me, the investigator can let it go. And everything that's said afterwards will be admissible in criminal proceedings. It's in any event admissible in administrative and civil proceedings. But the investigator can force an answer, in which case it will not be admissible in criminal proceedings. Because you do get some cases where criminal prosecution is really not an issue. In fact, most of our cases are like that. And in that instance, you would proceed and say to the person, I insist on an answer. But if it's one of those cases where you can see that the prosecution and the commercial crime unit will be interested, then you will not force an answer. So that's the overall layout of this clause. But there's been quite a few changes. I don't know if we should go through it one by one.
Are you two members, Benji?
And Chair, obviously this is a very onerous clause. Is there any precedent in any other act for a similar type of clause? And if this clause was to go through, which we very much don't like, for various obvious reasons, how would you prove that you told this inspector, I don't want to answer this or incriminate me, you know, and things like that. Would you? This is an uncomfortable clause for obvious reasons.
I understand. Madam Chair, how we do this is every interview, even, and I'm not just talking about formal interviews at the FSB, even an interview during a search and seizure, every single interview is recorded. So, if we don't do that, I think we will be the ones having trouble proving that this person was warned of his rights and given the opportunity not to answer. So in our best interest, we will always ensure that these interviews are recorded. Just maybe to mention something else, if we mess up on this one, it's very important that we don't. If we mess up on this one, there's the derivative rule in our law that says that information that we obtained at that stage unlawfully then, and any other information as a result of it becomes completely inadmissible. So we are very careful with this issue. It's a complete waste of time to collect evidence that won't be admissible.
Yeah, but this other part of the question was talking about precedence.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I don't know if there are precedents and other acts for this wording. I can see if we can find something.
Can I try to understand, Brendan, why do you believe it's onerous, so that we can look at the specific parts of it that you believe need to be compared quite differently?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's completely against the Constitution as well as criminal procedure and criminal law. At the moment in South Africa, you don't have, you should not ever be allowed to give evidence to incriminate yourself. It's just accepted that way. And I'd also be interested, has this clause got some form of a constitutionality advisory clause on it? Because I think this clause is probably going to could fall foul. This is some legislation that, not legislation, a court case before, a similar type of thing, I don't know. But I'm not aware of any act, I'm not an expert on what acts of the country, but that gives this type of power to force you to incriminate yourself and then not use it. Because strictly speaking, you could then use that information to go to another angle to get the same information which you can then prosecute about the person. So it's, I think it's a very counter to modern developed criminal law. So they'll have to do some serious convincing, I think, for a judge for the Constitution. So I'd be interested to hear what constitutionality clauses or advice you've got on this clause specifically in this paragraph.
Okay,
Jeff,
I've come to you.
The powers and privileges and immunities of Parliament and provincial legislatures, we have a clause similar to that, which says that if you are summoned by a committee, you have to answer all the questions required to answer, unless you have a lawful reason. And of course, one of those lawful reasons is incriminating yourself. But we go further in it to say that even if it does incriminate you, you must answer it, but then you receive the privilege of self-incriminating evidence that you would receive in a court. And to warn the witness, there's a requirement in the Act that a chairperson then warns, and it's in this written in the rules, you must warn the person that they are required to answer all the questions, a failure of which will constitute a criminal offence. If you say something that's incriminating against yourself, that is inadmissible in the court of law, except insofar as you need to prove that in a case of perjury or obstructing the ends of justice or something like that. So it's very similar. For me, what is critical here is, in the context of this FSR legislation, I think we're only going to deal with criminal matters. In Parliament, we're collecting evidence for oversight. And in amongst all of that evidence, there might be issues that could incriminate that person. So that we have it there. So I'm not sure if it counts in favour or against the inclusion of this piece of this provision. One thinks of it, most of what they will be dealing with is going to be criminal in nature. If somehow transgress a regulation or a standard that's been put there, instruction, or part of the law. So I would certainly say you have to allow, well, it must be consistent with the Constitution, otherwise we're just going to spend another R1 million on a court case. So we need to contact them.
If I give honourable leads, maybe the issue that we should have been discussing was whether the admissibility of information in the court of law, is it, because the understanding is that clarity has been provided by HERA that the information that will be probed will not relate to the criminality of the activities of an individual, but administrative. That's how I tend to understand the argument you were putting on the table. Unless if we're suggesting that here we're talking about an individual that will not be aware of their legal rights, then the question should have been, have you made them aware about incriminating evidence that they need to give? Because I think there is a standard procedure when interviews are conducted that you explain the intent and the object of the interview in advance to the interviewee to understand the type of information you seek. But I don't want you to take it for granted that it's done by the investigators in that particular order. And let me give to Roy. Don't you, should I give it? Then you cover it. You want to go first? Okay, let me give to Roy. I'll come back to you on level list.
Clarification. Our understanding from previous description is that it states nothing in this constitution for the track training. It says an answer given and a document or information as required in this paragraph. B is not admissible as evidence against the person in this paragraph. So it is the constitutional position. So this isn't the same as constitution from that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Firstly, to get to your last question, must the person be...
Madam Chair, the question is, and can be answered now, is a refusal to answer the question or submit the documents, would that be deemed to be a criminal offence, assuming that there was no criminality in the evidence required? So just simply refusing, saying I'm not doing it, what would be the consequences of doing that? And then why, if the documents are required, should you not go through the normal procedure of getting a warrant? Why not just do the right thing and get a warrant?
All of this is taking us a little bit backwards, but I'll be patient with him. Age before beauty, Gerard.
Thank you, Mercy. Let me start with maybe let me start with the last issue. Refusal to answer when the investigator has made that choice that whatever you're going to say will be inadmissible in the criminal law, in criminal prosecution. Refusal to answer at that stage will be a criminal offence. We will, of course, whoever does this job will, of course, use the search and seizure provisions when that is applicable and when that is the most practical and way to do it. But that does not, that's not an alternative for getting an answer out of somebody. You can't search premises if you can't get the answer. This is a question that's posed to a person that might not have any documentary backup. Obviously, the search and seizure will take place in any event. Madam Chair, your question about do we warn people of their rights? The answer is yes, but in this Act, we've made it peremptory that you must warn a person before you start the interview of his rights. So he or she must be fully informed of it, so you don't have to rely on processes for that. As far as the question about whether there's other precedents, I'm not sure about this, Madam Chairperson, but I understand possibly the Companies Act has a similar provision and the FIC Act, but we'll have a look at that. Then the question...
Can you come back with those answers so that it clears those concerns that Brendan will notice?
Yes, ma'am, we'll do that. Then there was the question as to whether there's any research behind this drafting. The answer is most definitely. This is a clause that we spend a lot of time on. We are very aware of the issues in this clause because we deal with it very often as investigators. So we did obtain senior counsel's opinion, and this clause, as we see it now, with the amendments, is written exactly along the lines of the advice of senior counsel. And then I think lastly, I just need to mention that one must keep in mind that this clause says one thing very clearly, and that is this evidence is not admissible for all proceedings. So the question really is, are we comfortable with the fact that it's admissible in administrative proceedings? Because criminal proceedings, there is no debate, it can never be admissible. And I think that's where the discomfort comes from. I completely understand.
What are the administrative acts says in this?
In administrative law, you are not exposed to the possibility of incarceration, so you don't have the protection that's afforded to you in terms of Section 35 of the Constitution, that of an accused person. So it's a different ballgame altogether, and there's ample case law about the difference between an administrative procedure and a criminal prosecution with the possibility of incarceration.
Advocate Sentis, can I kindly request you to bring us certain clauses of the Administrative Procedure Act and the Criminal Procedure Act to distribute to members to get their questions answered satisfactorily? Just those specific ones that refers to incriminating yourself, providing evidence, and so on. Because then it will bring this matter to, not now, but at least if it can, just to Brendan.
Madam Chair, maybe just ask to make it easier for us to understand a copy of maybe that senior counsel would be, can we just the relevant section, if it's relevant, if we can have a slide of it.
Proper nevertheless to refer to in this context, as far as I remember. I don't know. Let me leave it to your team, Momo, to decide what, how you want to do this. Brendan's got suspicion that this one will not hold water. I tried to request other additional documentation too, but he wants senior counsel advice on this one. Sorry? Also, members, don't put me in trouble with the real chair. I'm just holding forth, so I can't come with my own rules on how to proceed with this act. So please let's not make it cumbersome. Don't take advantage of the acting. I might give a bad report and I'll be charged from my acting position again. I will never see it again. So they are making my prospects very difficult by doing what you are doing. Okay. I think we need to move from this one and then go to the next one. Sarah?
Yes, Madam Chair, the next one, this chapter 10 on enforcement. So it covers quite a bit of ground. The first one is the guidance note, section 141, or now 141 if we make the change. That's basically just giving the institution the right to publish guidance notes.
So if you look at the chapter as a whole, it's providing a full suite of powers, enforcement powers. So it gives the regulators much more flexibility in terms of how they respond to which could be a risk of a transgression or a minor transgression or a major transgression. So I think just when we are looking at these clauses, just to be seen within that context. On the interpretation rulings, which is probably one of the major issues, we'd look for your guidance in terms of whether you want us to review those issues again.
Can we go closer to this so that members mightn't say that we did not consider them accordingly? I can see that Zuki is really obstructing them over there, and here we're dealing with a very important piece where we need everybody's attention. On it, did you hear what Kathy is saying? That there was a total overhaul on this one. So they want an indication whether you want to go clause by clause on it so that you can have a full understanding, or to summarize over it.
Excuse me, Chair, I wasn't proposing that you didn't go clause by clause. I think maybe just to say as well that the particular issue in terms of this chapter was on specifically on the interpretation, what we now term interpretation rulings, which had been called binding interpretations. And this was an issue around constitutionality that had been raised in particular by CISA, but also by other stakeholders as well. And the issue was relating to the concern that the regulator in interpreting a law, that interpretation in itself becomes law without going, as opposed to what we've described in terms of its regulation making powers, where it would have to issue for comments, get feedback, do an impact assessment, etc. This was seen as being able to be doing the same but just without the same checks and balances. And in terms of our engagement that we had with the stakeholders, it was not intended from our side that that the regulator could make law. And so we have corrected the phrasing to better align with what it's intended to do, which is promote clarity for the sector and for financial institutions, the regulated entities, as to how the regulator will interpret the law in terms of how they would take action. But then the action is not on the ruling, the action is on the original provision, and that this doesn't have the nature of law, and this is aligned with the treatment under of the equivalent SARS ruling.
Can I then give ASISA in this case to check with them?
Madam Chair, this is where our senior counsel is comfortable that the redraft of July has taken away any constitutional concerns.
Is that the feeling of the sector, basically? Hold? Oh, okay. Members?
They are comfortable.
I myself don't make my job difficult here. Okay. That's not freaking okay. They are very happy. Everybody is happy. Then I'm happy.
This clause has received a lot of attention. So of all the clauses, I think we probably have the least to worry about with this one.
If the chair, when he comes back, takes me back, I need to be protected that everybody was happy. Honorable East?
Madam Chair, I'm sure that it has received a great deal of attention. Just from a clarity point of view, so it's now a ruling, it's a clarification ruling, and you're comparing it with SARS ones. But if I ignore your ruling, what are the consequences?
So by ignoring...
It's an interesting question.
By ignoring the ruling, you are not in contravention of itself, and I'll ask for the expert to come in here. However, what it presents is that you as a financial institution are running the risk that the regulator will interpret the original provision upon which the ruling was based in that way, and so will take the action against that provision, not in terms of the ruling. And also an additional note is that this thing, it's not binding, so it's explicitly not binding on the financial institution itself. However, it is binding on the regulator. So the regulator can't then take an action which is different to what it has said in terms of that interpretation ruling.
So it's not law. It's not to be law. Honourable Lees?
So essentially, the regulator is making a decision about an issue prior to it becoming an issue, in a sense. So it's applying the law to a hypothetical situation and saying, if this occurs, this is going to be my ruling.
A warning, in a way.
So I'll ask the FFB to come in here. I think generally it's relating to practices which are being observed, or there has been a request as to what this actually means. But I'll ask the FFB, Jonathan.
Well, Jonathan, you want to say something?
Very much. I'll be very quick and then hand over to Joanne to expand. But so it is important. It's not setting. It's not making law. It's providing clarity on how the regulator is going to apply an existing law. So we sometimes get the problem that entities say, well, we're not completely clear on how to interpret this particular regulation or standard. So we issue it to say, well, this is how we commit, how we bind ourselves that we will apply the law in this way. So to give that clarity. But Joanne, I don't know if you want to add.
Yeah, I don't really want to add to anything people have said. It's just a tool we use to prevent situations where there's an ambiguity. And to give, and a lot of influence, it's mostly guidance to industry in terms of how they should be applying the provision, thinking that if there is maybe I can give an example. So for instance, if the insurance legislation talks about encumbrance, there was a lot of controversy or uncertainty as to what we would view as encumbrance. So we issued a notice saying, this is how we think we'll apply it, but the following things would constitute an encumbrance. So then there's clarity, everybody in the industry understands what the encumbrance means and how they need to report against it. So that's the purpose of it. I mean, we want to say, well, you didn't follow the correct procedure in encumbering your assets. We will be bound by that interpretation you've given. We can't at that point come to say, oh, but this situation will also now constitute an encumbrance. So it is basically following the SARS. But it's quite a useful tool to have, and a means with which one can actually deal with ambiguity without, on a quick basis in a fast, speedy way.
Madam Chair, absolutely. It does provide clarity, and if I agree with your ruling, that's great. I now know how to go about my business. But should I then disagree with your ruling? What recourse do I have?
It's not a ruling, how I understand it. It's a notice. Am I right to interpret it to be a notice? Because once it says the ruling, then it becomes law. If it's a notice about how rulings will be taken, it's to what Joanne said, to clear up ambiguity in terms of interpretations. Am I right?
What I'm saying is that there's a set of circumstances and there's a regulation that needs to be applied. The regulation is not clear, and a ruling is made as to how the regulator would apply that particular.
I must intervene. You see, what he has said. That's why I was trying to make it easy for you.
No, Madam Chair.
Because no. Can you hear me?
I have my opportunity to speak.
No. We don't have endless opportunities to speak at the end of the day.
Okay, then why are we here?
Okay. No. You see, you've taken us back on many issues, and we try to accommodate you on those issues. Your interpretation of this clause is incorrect, and we try to.
Not your role to tell me I'm free. I will do my own interpretation and I will decide if I'm in free.
I will decide the time allocated to you for your interpretations, honourable member. I'm in charge of the time. It's 12 o'clock as you speak. I'll stretch this to 1 o'clock. I will decide on the time. No, I want us to be clear on that one. I will decide on the time. We give on an issue for discussing. Can you, Joanne, clarify for the last time and we proceed, please?
So before we make an interpretation ruling, it's a process of consultation that needs to be followed to get inputs from industry. And once we've issued the ruling, if you disagree with it, you can also take us to court to get the court to reinterpret or attach a different interpretation to that we afforded to it.
I wanted to also clarify that this is a notice, not a ruling, because that's how we interpret it to be.
Yes, so, but it, maybe just to clarify, it's basically saying if it says this bottle is pink, the law, but we want to say it's actually Cherise, in terms of how we'll apply the law, that is what we'll put in the notice. And we'll say when we apply this, it will be this color, which is a very basic example. But before that, we do that, we publish the notice, industry can comment, the whole process in respect of consultation applies. Once we've considered those comments, which we can also be challenged if we didn't consider comments or we're acting unfairly, and then once it's issued, we will apply it to say that it is this color. If you disagree, to say no, it is actually a light pink color, then you may go to court, and the court's interpretation will always overrule any indication that we've given as to what the colour should be.
I'll be very patient on this one. I'll make sure that you explain thoroughly. Can you also explain the obligatory role of the regulator to provide that notice, to get the opinion of the sector, for them to be able to explain? You see, I'm going to and from, just to make you understand this one.
So if we look at clause 142.2, you say the purpose of a ruling is to provide clarity, consistency, and certainty in the interpretation and application of law. And then the next clause says that the authority will be bound by that ruling until any of the following circumstances prevail, like the court overturns the decision. In the obligation to consult on it is in subsection 7 to say before the responsible authority issues an interpretation ruling, it must publish a draft of the interpretation ruling and a notice calling for written public comment within a specific period in the notice, which period must be at least 1 month from the date of publication of the notice. And there's an obligation to publish it and make sure that people are aware of it.
Madam Chair, thank you for your patience with me and allowing a full explanation. Thank you very much.
Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. I don't like it when you become so impatient with me, but it's fine. I know I'm going to be in trouble with the chair, where I've done very little work. There's very little work we've done today, and time is running, so it's only on those bases. Where are we now? Oh no, it can't be me.
You'll pay our lunch, just a second.
Okay, can we move to the next one?
Okay, 132.
Yes. Of the following pass? That's inserted there. Are we happy with this? On one? Then on A, didn't we change the financial institution to say authority or something? Did you get it?
No, so yes, in some instances where we refer to the financial sector regulator, so depending on the context, and that was the challenge, which is why we've had to go through very carefully, in some instances it is a financial sector regulator, in other words, a general reference to the regulator. In other situations, it should refer to the responsible authority, i.e. the lead, in effect, the lead regulator on that.
Members? You happy? We go to B. Financial institution has been declared to the person. Maybe we should ask why. Do you reduce to a person? I asked the other day, is it a juristic person or is it a natural person in this context? Yes.
So here, remembering that this follows on from A and B, where A refers to a financial institution, B refers to a key person of the financial institution. So it's needing to be generalized then to apply to both.
You want this person?
Thank you. Also, with the proposed revised wording, it says the prudential authority may issue to either of the following persons. And so it's then the term person is referring specifically to those two categories of person in A and B, so in that context. So a financial institution or a key person, those are the persons that are being referred to there.
Members?
Brendan?
Brendan?
And a point of information. The prudential authority, let's say, changes the reserves requirements of a bank. Would they issue directives to that extent, for instance? Because this is only seems to go around the financial service, the financial product. The prudential authority, from my understanding, regulates the prudential aspects of a bank. So if he changes the prudential aspects, where would that come in? Is there another section? Because it says here, a financial institution that provides a financial product, right, or security services. I'm not sure the security services. But let's just say you've got a bank that doesn't give any financial products. Can you give a directive?
So I think in terms of the definition, of the product definition, all of the financial institutions that are captured by or required to be captured or under the jurisdiction of the prudential authority, those financial institutions are all issuing products. So a deposit is a product, for example. An insurance policy is a product. So all this clause is saying that for those institutions which are issuing those kinds are issuing products, then the prudential authority can issue a directive in order to achieve its soundness. Renati, would you like to express?
The definition comes from
Yeah, so as Kathy is saying, all of the financial institutions that the phase one through four would be product providers or security services providers.
Wait, were you thinking perhaps about the role of the conduct authority or? Okay, thank you. Roman figure one, the financial institution. I was looking at Roman figure one. I thought we agreed on B. And then we got to Roman figure one. If there's any comment. I'm trying to move a little bit faster, Kathy, unless if there's any other. 2A, there's an insertion of under a financial sector law or in relation to a financial product or financial service that provides or offers to provide. You see it, member? The insertion? Any comment? No? Yeah, okay. Then I think there's no changes in B, C, D. Then we can move to page 68. I don't see changes on 3, A, B, C, D, E. Remedying the
chair. If I can, if we can please look at 2B, and this was again just a added with
has contravened or is likely to contravene the financial.
It's just a clean up again. So we're proposing this addition into the clause where you can issue a directive to do a number of things, including where someone has not complied with an enforceable undertaking accepted by the prudential authority.
There's a new insertion, member?
2B.
Has not complied with an enforceable undertaking accepted by the prudential authority.
Mm-hmm.
So just to be clear, as I stated in the beginning, there are a full suite of responses, enforcement responses, that the regulator can adopt. One of those is an enforceable undertaking, which we will get to. And this thing was necessary to ensure that you can issue a directive in the case that they haven't complied.
Is
it
accepted by the prudential authority if it's already an enforceable undertaking?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the language?
So you're right, I think it would be, has not complied with an enforceable undertaking, but mindful that an enforceable undertaking could be undertaken by both the prudential authority and the conduct authority. So in this case, just to be clear, that the directive would be issued by the prudential authority against undertakings, the non-compliance undertakings of its own, as opposed to one that the conduct authority could issue. Otherwise, it would generalize it. And you're saying that the prudential authority can issue a directive for any enforceable undertaking. So I don't think it's much of a risk, but it's the correct.
Okay. The changes are in E, 1, 3. Go on the next page, member.
Yes.
Casey?
Chair, again, these are cleanups. The language. It's not a substantive change. Just to alert though to 3, again, it's the same issue as was raised in subsection 2, and subsection 3 just inserting there about the enforceable undertaking. So it's the equivalent provision for the subject.
Then let's move to 5. C says removing a person from a specific position or function in or in relation to the financial institution. Is there a word that is left out after financial institution? Or that's how it should be.
It's deliberate like this, but if you would recommend it.
D? I think there's no substantive changes. Then we come to F, which...
also raised an issue here, and the response from National Treasury is fine in as far as there is a MOU in place. And we had this discussion last week about these MOUs and the fact that they may never be put in place or etc., and we went through all that kind of stuff. But the fact is that the MOU may not be in place. It's an MOU between the regulators. When those MOUs are drawn up, what inputs would there be from the banks, for instance, on this particular issue?
Okay, honourable members, was personally not here on Friday. I don't know how far to discuss this one. Can I? Somebody, I was not personally on Friday, I don't know how it was agreed to.
Yeah, can you summarize
the
discussion Friday. So
since I don't want to reopen what has been discussed and finished on Friday, at least I get it. Joanne?
So this is a procedural requirement, and I think it stands irrespective of the MOU being in place or not. So if this procedural requirement is not met, then the directive may be attacked or challenged. And it specifically requires the concurrence of the staff with its stability hat on when the directive would relate to issues of stability. So in that regard, it needs to be concurrent, but it is a clear a step that must be followed. If the procedure isn't followed, you can challenge the validity of the directive on that ground.
I'm saying I don't want to reopen the discussion that took place on Friday because I don't know what the chair said. I'm not getting any indication from all members about but can we give it to Vasa to respond?
Chair, sure, we have from Vasa because of all the other checks and balances that have been involved in terms of coordination.
Okay, then let's, can we then move to F, I think, because there's a deletion of almost 25 plus to be replaced with the powers, its powers to issue regulator directives down there. Casey, can you take us through, please?
Sure. So I know it's quite a bundle to look at. Just to simplify that, the directive, this clause had dealt with directives by the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, and that has been moved into a separate clause. So you'll see the new 144. So in effect, what this is doing is it's separating out, again, for easier reading and interpretation, it has separated out the directives for the Prudential Authority in clause 143 to the directives of the Financial Sector Conduct Authority in clause 144. So that's the bulk of the deletion there. And then the closing. And so and then the remaining F and subsection 6, you'll see a clean draft, I think.
Just
to
see how it would read.
So
as it's before
about the financial institution removing the six, that's a continuation from E. And then six, subsection six, it's power to issue directives if a person is engaging or proposing to engage in conduct that contravenes which the Prudential Authority is a responsible authority. The Prudential Authority may issue a written directive to the person requiring the person to cease engaging, etc.
Okay. Do I have an understanding that 144 becomes the new insertion that actually separates those powers? Or directives 144?
So section 144 mirrors section 143, like we've just gone through, only it's tweaked for the language and the structure of the Financial Sector Conduct Authority and its objectives. So again, it's giving the power. So for example, it then talks about in 144.1, the Conduct Authority may issue a financial institution a written directive. But then the language it talks about, instead of talking about safety and soundness of financial institutions, it's talking about the fair treatment of financial customers.
Can we park the whole one until the chair is back, please? I'm not the chair on the list. Did he see this before he left? Can I get any indication? This close. So he has not had an opportunity to go through it. Can we be kind enough to let him also see this one? I don't have those powers. I don't want to impress myself and pretend that I have powers that I don't have. So we'll pack 144 as is. We can go to 145. Can you take us to 145?
Section 145 is again just a rewording and clarification. add in that, again, the difference between a key person versus a person here, it's not just a key person, so you'll see the deletion of key in relation to person. And again, these are cleanups that are, have, as we've gone through the bill and we've reconsidered the context, these are our proposed improvements.
Just a small thing, we're going to remove the word key in the heading as well there.
Removal of persons from positions.
Noted.
Thank you, Brenda. Well, can we move to the contractation requirements? Who starts on? Oh, he pretends that I don't compliment him when he do something good. I do all the time. No. We agree that we'll go until 1 o'clock. Automatically, what after that? Mumu will not like me if I don't, I let you off the hook now, because this team needs to come down here all the time. Okay. 146? Yes, I think they are happy. Can we get an indication in 146 if there's any issue you want to raise to try and pick up the pace, because I think we're not really doing as much as what has happened on Friday. And I believe. Period for compliance, 147. It's just a small change, the numeric and the regulator being inserted. Okay, we move to revoking directives, 148. The numeric and the same is regulators inserted, the same as 147.
Hmm.
Okay, compliance with directives, 149. Basa, I think you had an issue on this one. Are you happy with our outlook? This one. We're going to 150, it's just the numeric. Then we move to part 3, enforceable undertakings. On 151, it's just the numeric, but there's also a deletion of a legal instrument. It becomes enforceable by the responsible authority. Master, you had an issue here? Okay, thanks. We move to, there's no changes from 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, Roman figure 1, a deletion of appealing against. It now reads, no proceedings in a court in relation to the making of the order has been commenced by the end of the period of closing such appeals. I think it's just in Roman figure 2, deletion of an appeal has, and then in session, I don't think there's an issue there. Okay. Part 4, court orders.
Nothing.
Oh, no.
There's nothing there. And there another gazette. There's nothing on part 4.
One five two is the numeric. There's no changes.
Mm.
Excuse me, Chair.
Mm.
If you look at clause 1521A, it was reading a little bit strangely. It had read an order that a person do or must or not do. So we proposed an order that a person must do or must not do.
This unnecessary clause, aren't you inadvertently maybe potentially restricting your access to the court?
to these men. Aren't they restricting their access to the court? I mean, theoretically, anybody can go to court at any point in time. And as you say, well, the supposed authority can go to court for the following things. Aren't they restricting their access? Is it necessary to put that clause in like that? I don't
know.
Can I first ask our lawyer to tell us before you ask your lawyer? Advocate Jenkins?
The Constitution allows us, any person, to approach a court or another forum that can resolve a dispute. That's why we always say anything is challengeable, no matter what advice I give, it might be challengeable. Whether successful is another question, but probably also is.
I stand in Brendan's view.
If I may respond, no, we all have had
it. Get away from this one. He agrees with Advocate Jenkins that it's challengeable.
Simplify the wording, but I think it is important to understand that as regulators, we are creatures of statute. So every power we have must be afforded to us in a law. We don't assume legal workings just have certain powers, so we must be empowered. But on this portion, we can maybe just clarify to say we may start proceedings against the person in a high court to ensure compliance with the financial sector law. Then it is sort of wider than purely asking for an interdict or a restraining order. Mm-hmm.
Should they not just consider a clause 5 that nothing in this clause restricts the access of the responsible authority to court or something like that? So nothing can be interpreted to restrict the access to the court. Because it might be statutory, but it still has inherent right to go to court, I think. So.
Compliance is a must.
Mm.
In any law, am I right?
Yeah.
I need to be assisted by the lawmakers. Compliance is a matter of must, because here we are referring to compliance, or I don't know. Am I reading it out of tangent? The responsible authority for a financial sector law may commence proceedings against a person in the High Court for an order that a person must do or must not do a specific thing to ensure compliance with the financial sector law. How do I understand it?
If we can propose a simplification so that it just reads, so to delete the four, and to say the responsible authority for a financial sector law may commence proceedings against the person in the High Court to ensure compliance with a financial sector law, then it's not restricted to an interdict or mandate.
Sorry, just to add to your question, a financial institution must comply with the financial sector law, and there's a lot of requirements related to that. The concept here is to, it gives another tool to which to enforce that compliance. So perhaps also compliance with financial sector laws as a name, we can be more specific about.
But how will you cover the point that Benjamin has made?
I think our understanding is that as a creature of statute, we don't have any inherent power or a right to approach the court. It is only if we are afforded that right in terms of the law. So we are a little bit nervous by the provision to say, you know, it doesn't restrict any right to approach the court, because we have the opinion that we don't necessarily have that right. I think if we change the wording, as we suggested, it at least affords quite a lot more flexibility.
I think the concerns that have been raised are heard, and we will revisit the clause and come back with a proposal.
It's important to reconsider what he said. Do it. That's when you see lawyers not agreeing for the first time. No, comrades, please don't complicate it. You see, these lawyers don't agree on this one, then you're going to make my day very difficult. Okay.
complicate what Chief Justice. I was just saying there is no harm in reinforcing what may be deemed to be right in legislation. That's number one. But number two, just talking about the regulator, you know, you say they may approach the court if there is no compliance with the financial sector law. It's a general question. Is it not incumbent on any regulator to make sure that its licensee complies with all the laws of the Republic? Must you only restrict yourselves to the financial sector law?
I said it's going to make my job very difficult.
Okay,
Stephen,
I think
that's over to the legal expert. But you see, sometimes you don't agree on this. So that's why I wanted you to go and consult each other's views and bring it back later on. That's what I wanted them to do. They go and relook, and then when it comes, if we're not happy with it, because they will now consider also what you have raised now. But let me respond. Let them respond if there is an issue that can try to resolve it. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, ma'am. I appreciate what Honourable Buthelezi mentioned now, because one must be careful to say that we can't approach a court unless it's in our statutes. Because there are many, there's no statute that allows Parliament, if I can speak of my own position, to go to Parliament to get an interdict to prevent something happening, enforce a contract, to get out of a procurement exercise, to challenge a regulation, in fact, or to respond to a challenge on legislation. That's in the section, the constitutional provision is in section 34. Everyone has access. A court will, in my experience, from what I read, I never practice law, but a court will be very low, very slow to say, you don't have standing before me, therefore I can't adjudicate the dispute. That's generally not what courts do. Courts rather say, look, we'll find standing for you. Whether it's you've got merit, that's a different question. We will determine that. And that is also goes to the other part. In constitutional democracy, courts resolve disputes. Okay, so you need to have that power. I think there's nothing wrong, as Honourable Leder said, to reinforce it and to even give specifics to your officials within your organisation in legislation to say this is instances where we think you can or cannot. So there's nothing wrong with Clause 152 as it reads now with the amendment. But I would certainly urge any public entity or government department that they can rely on Section 34 of the Constitution to enforce their rights. The question of whether the responsible authority must enforce all the laws, of course, that's a budgetary issue. It's also an issue of jurisdiction, more of mandate. Now, the National Director of Public Prosecutions also comes in, and there's all kinds of other things. There's an information commissioner that's going to come in when it comes to the protection of personal information, etc. So the Human Rights Commission even can come in, because now we've put in the human rights issue into the legislation. So even they can look at socioeconomic impact of certain decisions, and people can go there for some kind of type of adjudication. So, ma'am, I wanted to just put it in context. That's all I wanted to do. It's not to say without this we can't go to court.
Yeah, it's the Honourable Swiss reinforce what I said about compliance. So, but because I saw that there was a different approach, I said, let me go back, and then when it comes there, it will be tidied up, So, Casey, Brendan wants to take a last. Brendan is almost 12, but I'm going to give you, I want to, can.
Madam Chair, I think your proposal that must go back is a good idea, but if we're wide enough, that would be dangerous, because that's effectively giving powers to those regulatory bodies. Fast their scope, you could never expect them to comply with all laws.
Taking a second advice against what all the laws this is, don't do it.
I think you can't expand this mandate to go and force
Let's leave it to them. It will come back. If we're not happy, we'll take another bite. I think that way it will help us. Because then,
yes, I think the points are all well made. We understand. We'll revisit and we'll come back with the
person. Okay. So try to. Okay. But it was not here in our document, no? Can you alert us if there's new changes? Because can we take the next one, please?
So on clause 153, and I'm just talking now on the original draft, the changes here are, again, it's a cleanup. We had reference an individual, we changed it to reference a natural person because that is the better understood term. There were also questions raised, so there have been issues raised around the period of debarment. So we've included in subsection 6 a change in that regard. And then the changes that you see on the screen are an improvement in language, changing it from in a material respect to a material way. Which has been indeed agreed in other clauses along this review process.
Well, I'm sure if I'm jumping in, that subsection 152, that where they killed individual person, they were natural persons, we put in they. Also, it's more grammatical. Bear in mind the intention, yeah.
What we'll do is we'll read, I think we can review the clause and just make sure it lines up correctly along the natural person reference.
Are you also saying 1-3 as well?
I think we will check it, but because these clauses are following on from sub-clause 1, where sub-clause 1 then talks about the natural person, the person in sub-clause 2, 3, etc. is within reference to the original natural person, so from a drafting perspective, I think this has been the preference.
Okay. But a person can also refer to a juristic person. A natural person is an individual.
Madam Chair, you can't debar a juristic person, you see. So I think for consistency, you will have to do
I think that's fine, and we can put it in to make it clear.
You mean to stay here, Katie? Because now I'm confused as well. How you define the person here in all of them,
okay,
from 2 to 4?
So in all instances, it's referring to a net. This is a debarment clause. So it's your capability of the regulator to debar someone. But it's a person, it's a man, it's like you and me. It's not an entity. So the reference here is to, if we look at 153.1, it refers to a natural person, so it specifies. Before it had been an individual, but then there was a question, well, what do we mean by individual? So a natural person is the correct language to use. And then the question around in the related clauses, we've only spoken about person. And that's not meant to mean it's now natural person plus. It was because of the sub-clause reading in relation to sub-clause 1, it was a drafting that you could then just refer to person because it was in reference to subclause 1, which refers to a natural person. But I think the point is made that to make it clear.
So if you made it one that is a natural person, is it given that all of the subsections will mean the same?
And that's the question. So the drafting had suggested that was the case, but if there's any uncertainty or if it's not sure, for better certainty, we can make sure that it's specifies that focus, as was intended to be.
I think he has a point. I think he has a point to specify that in this context he's a natural person.
Not a juristic
person. That goes for the only person is defined. And remember, the Interpretation Act will come in if any doubt. So you always put a provision, maybe natural person, in relation to paragraph 156, whatever, refers to a natural person. Yeah, refers to, or by the definition of person, you could say, with the exception of paragraph 156, where a person will only refer to a natural person. But it's probably not really annoying there.
Agree that we'll make sure it's dealt with.
Are you happy with the whole department order? Members? Is there any other new instructions, Kiki? Up until 6, I mean 7?
that I not from that trust. There's no new insertions.
And move to consultation requirements. Okay. Can take us through 1-4. It's just question again. It's similar to the previous class.
It's the same issue.
So it will be attended to. But there's a new insertion where a person cannot be located. If the responsible authority cannot locate a person to be given a document or information under section 154 or a debarment order leaving the document, information or order at the address of the person last known to the responsible is sufficient. Huh?
So if we look at one, it relates to 154. So in section, in clause 154, it places a requirement that before you can issue the debarment or make the debarment, that the authority needs to give the person, well, firstly has to give a draft to the person involved with the opportunity for that person to then make submissions on the debarment so that they have the right to defend themselves and say, well, I don't think I should be debarred because actually I'm not such a person.
Not where I have an issue, I've got an issue that so the previous address is sufficient, even if it's...
So if you'll just bear with me, please. So we 155, so because that is that obligation placed on the authority to give that right to the person to be debarred, there are many problems where you can't locate that person. And now the issue becomes, well, because you can't locate them, does that mean you can't actually affect the debarment order? So clause 155 is to deal with that case, and it's saying that where you can't actually find the person, you can... you can leave the leave the debarment information at the address of the person last known, so the debarment can still go ahead. Otherwise, you run the risk that the person scoots off and then the debarment doesn't hold. But if the FSD would like to come in, if you've got additional questions, we can ask them.
No, I want to leave this one for the chair himself when you come back.
Yes. Madam Chair, if I may just add to that. This is a person who already has a communication with the regulator. This is not out of the blue. So this is a person who should know he should change his address. And that's the first issue. The second issue is that this is a real problem. This is not something that we foresaw as a possibility. It is very hard sometimes to track such persons down, and then you're stuck with your order hanging in the air and going nowhere. To the detriment...
Isn't this example of this estate agent from KwaZulu-Natal similar? This sparrow of some sort that couldn't be found. The court still made an order against that. It's similar thing. So people do disappear when they feel the heat is a bit down, even estate agents.
Chair?
When I give honorable speech.
Chair, in where you've got a regulator, amongst other things, it becomes incumbent on everybody who's regulated to inform the regulator if he or she changes address. Right? For instance, when it comes to the law of agreement, a domicilium address that I give you when we make an agreement, if you change that address and you don't give me the your new address, it is assumed that you were in that address. I think it is applied in many instances.
At least you said something so far. It's only one member who said something. Honorable Liz?
Chairman, the reading here means, as I read it, means that should there be no one present at that address, it can simply be placed somewhere, pinned to the door with the old way with summonses, and that's the way I interpret it.
Now there's another interpretation of it. There's two interpretations thereof. We'll follow the law. What does the law say? The address that you provided previously becomes sufficient. Do you agree on that one? You see what they are doing? They are shaking their shoulders like this. Do you agree on that one? It's a new session.
I think it's an important point just to acknowledge that, by the Honourable Member, that these are regulated entities. If you are not being found, that does raise questions around whether you are an appropriate, whether you're appropriate to be a regulated entity, and the risk of leaving these particular persons running free, as it were, I think poses a chronic public interest concern.
Chair, my question is apposite in the sense that it says if a responsible authority cannot locate a person, so I'm a responsible authority, I go to the address and the person who is away, happens to be away at that point in time, is that now sufficient effort made to locate the person? What exactly, you know, what are the tests that apply about cannot locate a person?
Chair, can we then ask the FSB to come in with a practical example of how this is applied, and that would probably be useful for instructive. Could you give us an example of the debarment, of how you would go about debarment? So the question being, when it says that you just have to apply to locate the person, what does that actually mean in practice? As if so, you don't want a situation where you're just putting the notice on the door, and that then has been your attempt to find or locate the person.
Yeah, I think we might be moving towards saying that you at least must put in an effort. So maybe we can work around that, say, after diligent search or something to that effect that you sometimes see in legislation. I don't know if that's what the council agree with that.
See, in legislation, you don't outline the procedure followed when you try to locate a person. You don't outline it in the legislation that I sent a messenger three times and there was nobody there, and these things are challengeable. So how we call it becomes very important, that tomorrow a person can say, I still stay in that address, I have never received any notice, because it doesn't explain how you're going to provide the notice. So I was trying to make you aware in a way by, you know, trying to not say it in words, because it doesn't say, it just says if a responsible cannot locate. And a person can argue, no, the postal service strike was there, I never received my documentation. So how you locate the person must be defined in such a way that it covers all aspects that can make it challengeable. It's not about whether it's persons or entities. I know that here is the biggest big issue you're trying to and Honorable Professor put it nicely, that it's the owner is on them to provide information of change. It's not even only on change of address. It might still be the same address, but that information of department might have not reached. So it is not clearly defined. And it's about the very same trying to make legislation bite. And if you get the point I'm trying to make. So how it's structured, I don't know. I might not have immediate.
No, I mean, we can check. I just, the more we talk about it, the more reading the section 154, because remembering it's following on from the clause 154. The clause, the obligation is actually in, it's written in 154. So there it places, that's describing what the regulator needs to do in terms of satisfying its requirement and making the debarment.
Which 154 are you referring to?
So if we look at 154, before making a debarment order, A says give a draft of the debarment order to the person and to the financial sector and the other financial sector regulator, along with reasons for and other relevant information for the proposed debarment, and B, invite the person to make submissions on the matter.
answering the question carefully. It does outline giving a draft, and because this one is on its own. It speaks about location, so it doesn't speak to the previous one. I read the previous one. Brendan?
Yeah, I concur with you. 155 effectively overrides 154. So I think the word diligent search is too strong. Maybe they must rework it. It's something like reasonable. The bottom line is, in law in South Africa, domicilium is like 10 years a will. It's a well-known concept. Labour law, this is common to have served notices in terms of various laws at the last known address. But at the same time, because of the severity of this, I think adding some type of a reasonability of is a good idea. So let them rework it.
I think we agree with that. We can do so.
I'll always unleash you, Brendan. You are the strongest link to what I say. Part 6. Business agreement, 156. Okay.
So here they are. It's minor changes. Just the numbering changes you've identified already, and then in sub clause 5. Clean up in the language.
Okay. Can you agree that we do chapter 11 very quickly?
Let me show you clarity while you're looking on this 156. This leniency plus bottom line only deals with administrative type of things. They were not going to give leniency for criminal prosecution, I presume. So it's purely administrative in terms of this act, not in terms of criminal prosecutions.
Mr. Madam Chairperson, I can reply to that. That's entirely correct. We have no jurisdiction to indemnify persons against criminal prosecution, so that is only as far as our regulatory and enforcement activities are concerned.
Okay.
So practically, I presume they will need opportunities to give leniency for criminal actions at some point. Is there a need for an opportunity to be able to discuss with the prosecuting authority? Do we need to put anything like that in here? I know practically that will probably happen, but since you're worried about your powers, do you have the power to actually ask the prosecuting authority to theoretically work with you on a leniency agreement for criminal as well as the administrative side? If it's not necessary, then it's fine, but if it's necessary, maybe it should be considered.
I can imagine the day they do that, there will be contravening the criminal act by providing criminal leniency. It will never be their jurisdiction. I don't know. Unless if you are venturing into something interesting, because I thought you've got administrative power not to act on criminal cases. It's the jurisdiction of, so unless if there's strong motivation, I don't know what will be that motivation, but can I respond to it maybe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think underlying to that statement is of course the knowledge that to try and set up something like with the criminal prosecution authorities will push you back a few years. The investigation that we do and the investigation that the criminal authorities do are quite different, and as such I don't think they would ever agree until they've done their own investigation. So we are really here just looking at our jurisdiction and at the actions that we want to take, and keep in mind that most of our work does not have a criminal element to it. In those rare cases, if it's insisted on the other side that there must be a criminal indemnity as well, I would say I would leave that to the other party to sort out. In fact, that's what we do now. If somebody tries to bring that into an enforcement committee penalty agreement, we will say we can't. It's outside our jurisdiction, but you are welcome to have that discussion with the NPA. I've never had a case where that happened, actually. If the case is so severe that it requires the attention of the criminal prosecution authorities, I don't think we'll mess around with this section in any event. We'll just go straight there.
can also be submitted to abuse by the other parties, where they want to pursue a criminal case and want to justify it through administrative information they used from you. Is there that unintended consequence of thereof? You might have looked it from the administrative side, but there's also an element of which hand that can occur from the other side. So the jurisdiction should be very clear. The line should not be blurred. I don't know.
Yes, Madam Chairperson, the jurisdiction is very clear, and it is protected very jealously by the criminal prosecution authorities. They will not allow any inroads into that.
Brandon?
I'm fine, so I think I just, because of the difficulties to get the criminal prosecution authorities to do things, and I'm thinking practically of the financial matter, that could have been brought down much quicker. We could have saved a lot of people a lot of money had there been ability to indemnify the financial director, Graham, and all the other guys earlier. You know, so it could speed up the administrative side of closing down things, but let's leave it. Because primarily because the prosecuting authority is much slower than the FSB, for instance, or whatever.
One of the pros and cons of
so the administrative actions are actually a very important component. And I think, like Sarah said, the prosecuting side is different, and you know, they jealously guard their independence, rightly. You may get hit with two, but at least the one will apply when there are transgressions.
Thank you. As such, I was a little bit adventurous to think we can go to part 11. Time is not on our side. Okay. Should we take one class? Okay. Okay. Because at least by 1 o'clock I must release them. They will just vanish if we don't release them by 1 o'clock.
Board
might just have 1% of the shareholding, but you really are actually 15% of the organization. That's sort of what you're trying to achieve in this bridge. So if your consent is required for the appointment of 15% of the members of the governing body, or you obviously together or alone with another person, you hold a qualifying stake, and we'll discuss the qualifying stake soon, but that really is what the basically a 15% and then three, sorry, it is actually just an outcome of the track changes, but it is, and I think it's a moving, obviously, it isn't really huge. But it does say that the, you know, the Minister and Reserve Bank are not significant owners in any capacity, and that's just to be sure that where we are, if the Reserve Bank, for example, owns a financial institution, that they aren't significant owners. And then there was a request from stakeholders in the public hearing that there might be instances where somebody is a significant owner, but that isn't really practical or necessary. So we are proposing a clause to say that the regulator may declare a person not to be a significant owner. That's four, that's you. And then under B, you know, you can't do that if that doesn't prejudice of the achievements of your objectives. And I think we had discussed this earlier, but there was a proposal that we actually don't use the word achievement of his objectives, but we actually refer specifically to the objectives in section 33 or 57. So I think it was a question on that this might be new day, so we try to clarify that. And then obviously before you do that, so D, you know, you must follow due process, and so will I give the person notice of the action and the statement of the reasons of it and give them appropriate time to make submissions on the matter. That also came up quite a lot. And E, the time period that you would want to give them to make submissions in the month. And you know, it's just process issues. So it's basically just to ensure, I think there was a lot of concern from stakeholders that they just wanted due process to follow. So obviously I make a position with them, J needs some full submission, and K needs public support.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Roy, can you just remind us, sometimes since we discussed this thing, what was the rationale for the 15%? If you can remind me about that. And then how does one, and perhaps Frank needs to answer this, 4E, what does 1 month mean? I know the law does specify these periods, but what does it mean in this context?
Any comments, maybe? Roy?
Thank you, Chair. Actually, rationale for 15%, that is the number we have currently in Bank Act. And I think we can ensure that. So we don't want to create some funding system that might have to extend to multiple boards. So it'll be a balance of 10%. And then on the 1 month, I think I'll refer to
just an add-on note, also the takeover regulations 50%, and there's, I think maybe that's another reason for it. What were the of the people who made comments, I think Barca and others, are they happy now with the strata?
Let's hear from Bertha.
Yes, we agree with the clause, the revised clause, Jane.
Honourable Chair, this clause, I think,
members have agreed to take what they've got. Thank you. It's further on that there is a bit of an issue when we get into clause 159, but that will no doubt be for the next session. Thank you.
The issue is 159. Okay. So even those who raised issues of percentages today, they forgot Pinky and the likes, you know, they are happy and everybody's happy. And I said, if everybody's happy, I'm also happy. So let's risk taking 158, qualifying six.
Okay, so qualifying six, as you said, this really, there was no concern about the wording, but it was confusing. So what we tried to do is simplify the wording, and it really boils down to, if you have 15% of the shares of the financial institution, if you can exercise the control, if you can extend the voting rights, if you can dispose of control of the disposal of 15%, so we're basically just using 15% as a line. And I can go to everyone, but basically, in every situation, what we're trying to do is bring it back to the 15%.
Members? They look tired now. Are you hungry now? Too quiet. I think they are hungry. So that's not fair on them. Okay, I don't think they've got an issue. I thought this was a report. I can stay here for the better part of the day, and then I get in trouble. They are going to the chamber at 2, they need to eat. I'm not going to push it beyond this point. They need to, we should have stopped at 12, but we're stopping at 12. No, that's committees are supposed to stop at 12. That's the rule. So we always take we've always touched an hour in our committee. So that's, thank you very much for the inputs. They were useful.
Not on this matter, but on a committee matter that I would like to raise.
Oh, okay. Do you want to raise after the discussion is left? Okay, thank you very much for the effort. And I need to apologize, Casey, Roy, and Tim Momo, that you couldn't push more than. Okay. Thank you.
How are you? It's a minimum. And then for the NCC, what is the last? It was this week or last week?
Can you please, please, bye. We still love you. Bye.
night. Yeah. See you. Who's born in this?
Oh, yeah, we really